This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of March 12th, here are a few top stories. In the news, students across the country walked out of classrooms in solidarity against gun violence. Here's KJZZ's Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger.
Yesterday at 10 o'clock in the morning, high school students across the country staged walkouts to mourn the 17 shooting deaths at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida and to protest lawmaker inaction at gun reform attempts.
Yesterday on the show, KJZZ's Casey Kuhn was on the scene in Glendale at Mountain Ridge High when senior Jacob Sumner walked with hundreds of his classmates to the football field, where they held a moment of silence for each of the victims of America's ninth deadliest mass shooting in modern history. And the show's Lauren Gilger caught up with Jacob earlier this morning to talk more about his experience, and Lauren's with us now. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. So Jacob told me he was surprised by the number of students who decided to join him in walking out yesterday, and he hopes it will send a strong message about what his generation believes.
I was really excited to see that so many people would come out to show their support for what we were doing, because I think it is definitely something that needs to be taken care of.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the response from your school's administration. Did they support this? Did they work with you to organize it?
So originally, our original plan was to go out to 67th Avenue and we'd walk along that for a bit. That idea was not endorsed by admin at all. They were threatening a 3-day suspension and seniors would jeopardize our right to walk in graduation. So we met with them. We came up with a plan that they would let us use the football field instead with no discipline action taken. And we went from there. So admin at us endorsed that idea.
So how did you approach organizing this?
We started a Twitter account for it. We tweeted about it all the time. We started a texting service for it so that we could talk to the people who didn't have Twitter, and we ended up reaching quite the number of people over the 3 weeks that we were planning it.
I wonder where you heard about this larger march that was happening and why you wanted to participate when students all across the country and all across our state and city were also going to do this.
So right after what happened in Florida, I was really upset, and I knew I didn't want this to happen again. We've had way too many of these mass shootings. And I saw students in Florida walking out. I saw students across the country walking out. And then the Women's March came out with a National Day of Action yesterday. And I was talking to my friends and said, let's do this. Let's make an impact. And let's show them that we've had enough of this and we want some common sense gun control measures to be passed to prevent this in the future.
Yeah. A walkout is such a traditional form of protest. I wonder, have you ever done anything like this before, or is this something you've only read about, like, in history books?
I've never done anything like this before. This is the first large-scale, like, protest I've organized, but I've read about them in textbooks. I just came from my Gov class, and we're learning about civil rights right now. So Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, the women's rights from the early 20th century. We're learning about all that right now. So got some inspiration from that.
Yeah, yeah. How did it feel to be out there on the football field yesterday with all of your classmates?
It was a really inspiring moment just to see how many people came out and how many people actually cared enough to get out, to walk out of class and show their solidarity for what we were trying to accomplish. Riley gave a speech and we had people crying out there because it was an emotional speech. We read the 17 names of the 17 victims who died in the Florida shooting. And it was just an emotional experience, I think, for all of us.
So when the shooting in Parkland happened, and obviously you've grown up with shootings like these happening across the country, what was it about this one that made you, as a young person today, say enough is enough?
Well, I think part of what it was the fact that the students who survived that shooting, they started to speak out. And that kind of inspired me to speak out and join them, knowing that even though we're 3,000 miles apart, they're my peers. They go to high school. This could have happened at my high school, and some of the victims could have been my friends.
Yeah. Do you think that this kind of energy and activism around this issue is sustainable, or do you see it kind of dropping off as people kind of forget and move on to the next thing?
Well, I think with anything, you're going to have some momentum start dropping off the farther you get away from the event. The big thing is going to be CAD groups like the Parkland students. Can they continue to get to keep the momentum going and keep people interested and involved in the movement the closer we get to November, which I think the March for Our Lives in a couple weeks and then the next walkout, April 20th, will be a big factor in pushing for the momentum to keep going.
Yeah. So looking forward, you're going to be old enough to vote soon if you aren't old enough already. And there is a large movement around the country of students your age speaking out about this. Do you think anything will change?
I think something will have to change. Either we're going to vote out a lot of the politicians who refuse to take action, or they're going to decide they want to keep their jobs and they're going to take action. So I think either way, something is going to happen.
Jacob Sumner is a senior at Mountain Ridge High School who helped organize the walkout there yesterday in protest of gun violence. Jacob, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.
Now for a little something different. It might be a new way for you to spend a Saturday afternoon.
Axes are a tool for chopping down a tree, for splitting wood, but here's a new use, throwing them at a target.
Wait, why would you want to throw an axe at a target?
Excellent question. That's exactly what the show's Anika Klein went to find out right in Tempe.
Just think of it like darts. But the darts are axes. You won't find it at a dive bar in the corner behind the pool table, and there are definitely a few extra safety precautions involved.
We just ask that after you throw your axe, keep an eye on it. If it's coming in your direction, simply just step out of the way. Don't try to be a hero, catch it out of midair, anything like that.
Here at Lumberjacks's, and yes, that's a portmanteau of lumberjack and axes, the lanes are set up a little like batting cages with a wooden target at the end.
We start everybody off and highly recommend you throw with two hands, at least to start.
Francesco DiNardo works at the newly opened location, the first in the valley. He's explaining the rules to a group of six guys. None of them have done this before.
Yeah, I've chopped wood before, done things like that, never thrown axes.
Definitely not a professional axe thrower at all.
Shane Hagelin, Jojo Campson, and their other coworkers are here for a team building event that involves some friendly competition. But before any of them can have bragging rights in a round robin tournament, there's a helpful practice round. Well, the guys are discovering it's not as easy as it looks. And I'm discovering that the sound of hitting a bullseye is really similar to the sound after a total miss. As the tournament starts, it's time to think about strategy.
Started off a little rough. There's a little skill set to it. You gotta just watch your speed, watch your hand throwing.
JoJo's coworker, Chris Marinick, is also getting into the swing of things.
You want to throw it as hard as you can, but it doesn't work out that way. You gotta just kind of finesse it in there. So it's not as aggressive as you think it'd be. I guess it's kind of like curling on TV, you know, just very gentle.
The sharp axe blade couldn't be further from a smooth curling stone, but Chris has a point about finesse. The axe has to rotate just right for the blade to actually stick in the wood. Just partway through the tournament, and the group skills are sharpening.
That is the beauty of this sport.
That's Corey Deasy, co-owner of Lumberjacks's.
When you get an axe to stick, it's an extremely satisfying feeling to get sharp metal to stick in wood.
Oh, he's on a roll right now.
Corey believes that almost anyone is cut out for this activity, and he thinks it'll take hold as a bona fide sport in the U.S., as it is already in Canada.
And people call me crazy, but I wouldn't be shocked if this makes it into the Olympics in a few years.
But for now, it's all about besting your buddies. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Science Desk, can you still open some of your old files on your new computer? Let's hear about the need to preserve old software. Here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
Technology changes in dramatic ways every day, but sometimes, like with those constant software updates we're asked to make, it feels like the changes are happening every minute. And we've seen a lot of very popular programs simply disappear, never to be opened again. But now a team from Yale University is working to restore some obsolete software applications. And to learn more, I'm joined by Ewan Cochran, Digital Preservation Manager at Yale. Ewan, why is it important to preserve the software that's been around before and may have been deemed to be outdated?
Software is an important cultural object in its own right. I mean, there's been so many software applications from the past that really influenced society. I can think of things like Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia that was software-based. But also, most of us remember things like the different interfaces that we interacted with using software back in the 80s and 90s that really, when you see them, they kind of give you this emotional connection to that period of time. Things I'm thinking of, like if you ever use WordPerfect that presented you with just a plain blue screen. And if you compare that to something like Microsoft Word today, that is a completely different experience. And then the second main reason, which I think is probably the most important, is that without preserving the software, we're not going to be able to properly preserve access to the content that we want to preserve from the past. So much content, digital content, has been created over the past 30 years that what we like to call born digital, so created in a form that's only ever been digital, and to interact with that content and make sure we can still access it in the future, we often have to have that original software. Otherwise, either you can't open the files, or when you try and open them, the content can be distorted or changed in ways that can significantly change the meaning.
The word that did come to mind for me in part is nostalgia. A lot of us are sort of into things, not only because we may have fond memories of them, but because we're very comfortable with how they work. Does that word play a part in all in this? Not as to why you're doing it, but as far as how it fits.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I like to talk about this concept called that I call digital patina. You know, when we open up these old applications, when you open things in the original software, it makes them look old and feel old and gives you an emotional connection to them. I mean, one thing that always resonates with a certain group is when I show Microsoft Word 97, which had Clippy in it, that little office assistant that was both irritating and just kind of makes you nostalgic. It reminds you of that period in time because you always remember the frustrations you had with that little application.
As with anything, though, there are challenges involved. Are there certain basic challenges that you'll need to overcome?
Yeah. So, I mean, the core work of this project is two parts, or maybe three, but we're installing old applications on simulated emulated computers, which will then be, those emulated computers run on modern hardware and can be accessed via a web browser. So eventually users will be able to access their content in the original software via a regular web browser. So in addition to setting up all those computers, we're making it so that everyone can access them by establishing a network of organizations that are running the software that enables you to access those simulated computers running the original software. And then through the course of doing that, we have to do things like actually find that software and configure it and install it. And there's a lot of technical challenges involved in doing that. And we need to establish also that just the software infrastructure, the ability to provide access to those emulators in a networked set of, between a networked set of organizations. So there's technology building and development work to be done to do that. And that's a challenge. But I think we have that one pretty under wraps. The more difficult problem longer term is the intellectual property side, whereby a lot of these applications have some sort of copyright associated with them, and we need to establish the appropriate mechanism by which to provide access in the context in which it's the owners of that copyright are comfortable.
For a lot of people, at least, technology advances in some ways beyond what their need is, beyond what their capacity is. And so it almost feels as though the software preservation is almost too logical because in many ways, software is changing not necessarily for the needs of a consumer, but because that's the company, it's sort of how a company makes money. So I'm wondering if, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Honestly, I'd probably flip that on its head. I have to deal every day with the problems that come from software rapidly evolving over time. And, you know, new files and new formats come to us, you know, every day, basically, and we have to figure out what to do with them. But I really think that's always going to happen because what happens is the users of the software ask for new features and the software vendors go and implement those new features and the existing software doesn't have it. So they have to add it to a new application. And and deploy that out to their users. And so the old applications slowly become obsolete simply because users need new features. Whether every user needs them is an interesting question, but there certainly are bleeding edge users that need them. An area that I have a little bit of experience in is architecture and design software. And that one is always pushing the edge of new features. They do things like add the ability to interact with 3D models of, say, a building or a ship in virtual reality. And to add that feature, they need to change the application and change the file format that saves the information that you create in the application. And that's just inevitable. New things keep coming with this, with software and with society. We want to move our abilities forward.
Ewan Cochran is Digital Preservation Manager at Yale University. He joined me via Skype.
From the business desk, Phoenix is close to signing a multi-million dollar deal to help bring the Thunderbird School of Global Management downtown. As Christina Estes reports from KJZZ's Downtown Bureau, the move from Glendale to Phoenix comes after ASU took control of the private, nonprofit university about 3 years ago.
Plans call for a new building at the northwest corner of 2nd Street and Polk, next to ASU's law school. It will house Thunderbird's graduate and executive programs, along with office and retail space. Phoenix Economic Development Director Chris Mackey told the Downtown Subcommittee it makes financial sense to lease the city-owned land to ASU at no cost for the first 10 years and kick in more than $13 million from a community reinvestment fund.
As we look at the 350 students for Thunderbird, we'd see approximately a 700 direct and indirect jobs, the additional jobs that would come as part of Thunderbird, with an economic impact of approximately $40 million a year.
ASU says it will contribute approximately $100 million between the educational building and student housing. If the full council approves, an interim facility could be ready this fall. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to KJZZ, and this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Finally, from the Fronteras desk. On Thursday, the Navajo Nation will hold its reservation-wide competition to decide who will represent the tribe at the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Facing off against the best spellers across the country is a big deal, no matter where you're from. But if you're raised on the Navajo Nation, where learning English is a part of a painful past, competing in the Scripps Bee is a major accomplishment. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Parfait. That was the winning word for 12-year-old Brianna Hostein at the qualifying spelling bee in Tuba City last month.
Parfait. P-A-R-F-A-I-T.
Brianna, a 7th grader at Tuba City Boarding School, is a big reader. She likes science fiction and mysteries best. Still, she hadn't pictured herself in the Navajo Nation spelling finals.
I don't know, I just felt really happy. I didn't think I could make it that far.
Brianna's parents are both teachers. Her dad, Leslie Hostein, who is working on his graduate degree, says education is a top priority in their family.
In our culture, I mean, we have a quote that says, go, my son, go climb the ladder of education. You know, education is the way out.
The way out?
It's a way out of poverty.
Half of the tribe is unemployed. A third still lacks electricity. Many families don't have computers to download spelling words. In addition to poverty, students also may be struggling with language. In the late 1800s, during the American Indian Wars, thousands of Native children were forced to attend federally run schools, where the main objective was to wipe out Native culture. Teachers beat children and washed their mouths out with soap for speaking their language. It even happened here at the Tuba City Boarding School. A century later, these brutal methods were shut down. But Northern Arizona University professor Manley Begay says English has become the dominant language.
When you come from this historical trauma impact on language use, it's amazing that any Native child is actually competing in the spelling bee. And I think just because of the historical nature of language loss and assimilation that has occurred.
Begay says the whole, quote, kill the Indian, save the man assimilation philosophy has had a mounting impact on the Navajo tribe, beginning with his parents.
And then my generation, we've been exposed in a variety of ways with the remnants of the boarding school era, where at times whole families now don't speak Navajo or don't speak native language because assimilation worked.
The majority of Native Americans in Arizona speak English at home, according to the latest U.S. Census numbers. But Begay says the English spoken on the Navajo Nation is a different dialect.
Navajo is a very verb-based language, and English is very noun-based. It's a difficult language to decipher. There comes a time when individuals and families intermingle Navajo and English together. And I've heard some folks say Navalish, you know.
As far as literacy goes, bilingual education professor Jenny DeGroat says language plays a key role.
Our students, although they do speak English, still struggle a lot with academics.
DeGroat would like to see more bilingual Navajo children. Many Navajo parents either don't know Navajo well enough, or they were ridiculed for speaking it, or they don't see it as a useful language to pass on to their kids. Recent studies show many benefits to bilingualism, not the least of which is a greater sense of cultural identity. Seventh grader Brianna Hostein is exposed to the Navajo language from her aunts and uncle, but English is the primary language spoken at home. And English is her sole focus, at least until the spelling bee.
My fifth grade teacher, I go to her class every day after school, and I have a big binder full of words that she helps me pronounce, and we just go and look them up.
If Hostein wins the Navajo Spelling Bee, she'll go to Maryland for the Scripps National Spelling Bee at the end of May, where kids from all sorts of backgrounds will compete for the top speller trophy. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.